And good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte, and I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. We're just got rotating Schultes or something here this morning. It's weird. But anyway, we have one of our regular favorite guests with us during the second hour of Focus 580. Dr. Suzanne Troopman is with us during this hour. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine and an obstetrician and gynecologist at the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure. If you have a question that you would like to ask Dr. Troopman this morning concerning women's health, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we're coming up on the month of October, and that's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And I think in our community there'll be a number of different activities, and we're doing a breast camp at my secondary office. That's our cosmetic medicine office, and we're introducing to many of our patients the new breast pap smear. Mm-hmm. It's been a radical new development in the attempt to diagnose breast cancers in their most early stage, and a new step forward towards prevention of breast cancer. Mammograms are talked about a lot. They're very important. And, of course, in Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we'll be talking to all of our patients about getting their annual mammograms over the age of 40 as a very important step to identify very early cancers and get those treated. But the idea behind the breast pap smear is to identify the precancerous changes of the breast that occur prior to those cells actually becoming cancerous, and looking forward to the time that if we identify subsets of patients that are very high risk, we can do other things, perhaps in older patients, get them off of hormones, perhaps in patients over the age of 35, consider starting the breast cancer prevention medications. And there's been a new breakthrough in terms of that. We now, in addition to the medication tamoxifen that has been approved for breast cancer prevention, the osteoporosis medication raloxifene, which most patients would know by the brand name of Avista, has now gotten approval both as breast cancer prevention and for breast cancer prevention in women with osteoporosis. So breast cancer prevention in women who are high risk, as well as women with osteoporosis. So a lot of advances in the area of preventing breast cancer, which, as you know, is one of the most common cancers in women. It used to be the most common. I think lung has actually recently surpassed breast, but still extraordinarily common cancer, over 200,000 probably diagnosed this year.
Is breast cancer, as you mentioned, I think probably cancer is on the mind of almost everybody in some form or fashion. Is breast cancer the number one concern for women's health?
I think that many women do have breast cancer as a significant concern, and many women profess that breast cancer is their number one women's health concern. Of course, the physicians try to remind patients that their number one medical concern, particularly as we get older and move towards our 40s and up, is heart disease. And actually, heart disease as a concern dwarfs breast cancer in numbers, but that shouldn't minimize the importance of either condition.
Mm-hmm. If you have a question for Dr. Suzanne Troopman this morning, a women's health question, give us a call at 333-9455, or if you're outside of the 217 area code, you can call 800-222-9455. You mentioned briefly osteoporosis,
and you know, when you talk about a woman with osteoporosis, we usually think of that individual as having lower estrogen, and therefore she has a certain set of risk factors that predispose her to lower bone mass overall, as opposed to our breast cancer patients, where we tend to think of them as a higher bone mass overall. And higher estrogen states and less risk for osteoporosis. Interestingly, some of the medicines that we use to treat breast cancer may, in fact, put some patients at more risk for osteoporosis. So there's always other factors that we're learning about with these conditions. But in the treatment of osteoporosis, which is very significant women's health concern for American women, we have a new drug that was just approved called Reclast, or it's zoledronic acid, and it's in the bisphosphonate class and the other medicines that are in the bisphosphonate class that we've discussed at length on other shows are Fosamax and Actonel and Beneva. I know a lot of people have seen the Sally Fields Beneva commercials. That's what my patients tell me, so I think it's pretty effective. And I think that's excellent because it's an excellent medication. I was involved with some of the research trials with Beneva as well as Actonel. And now we have a new medication called Reclast. And this medication is radically different. When the first bisphosphonates came out, we had to take a pill every single day. And when you swallow bisphosphonate, the number one side effect tends to be what we call GI side effects, but tends to produce a little bit of heartburn type symptoms, esophagitis, a little bit irritating on the stomach and the esophagus for some women. And it's a little bit fussy to take because bisphosphonates aren't well absorbed orally. So you have to take them with full glass of water on an empty stomach and not lay back down and not eat again. And so there are women who either can't stick with that regimen or find it difficult to stick with that regimen. So the bisphosphonates have been moving towards getting dosing regimens that are a little bit easier to cope with. And the first longer-term regimens were Actonel and Fosamax, where you take the medication once a week. And then we had Beneva once a month. And now Beneva also comes in a four times a year intravenous infusion, where you get hooked up to an IV four times a year. So you at least don't have to swallow. And now Reclast, which is also a bisphosphonate, but it has the most high affinity to the hydroxyapatite of the bone. So it binds so tightly to the bone that it is an actual once a year IV infusion.
Really?
So just like you get your basic checkup once a year, you can get your basic bone treatment once a year. And many women, I think, will really find this a very effective method. And side effects vary. Some of the minor side effects that they list are the typical kinds of side effects you find with most medications. And an uncommon subset of patients will get sort of an achiness from the infusion. And we've been doing research trials to help figure out what medications to administer to combat with that. We've come up with working with the company. They've had many alternatives that have been successful that they're working on, and they're still working on others. And we're actually enrolling one of those trials right now still. But it is actually an approved medicine for osteoporosis treatment. And actually, it reduced the risk of vertebral fractures by 70%. And clinical vertebral fractures were actually 77%. And it even reduced the non-vertebral fractures, so the hips and wrist, other places that you can fracture if you have osteoporosis, significantly by 25%. So we think that it's going to be an excellent alternative because we know that compliance is a big problem. And for individuals who don't take particular consistency with their dosing will not have as effective treatment. So if you're on a medication where you're supposed to take it once a week, if you start missing doses, the interval between the missed doses becomes long enough that it can affect your effectiveness of your medicine.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopman, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine and an obstetrician and gynecologist at the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign. Our numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you're outside the 217 area code and you have a question for Dr. Troopman. As far as osteoporosis goes, is it a preventable a disease, or will we all get it at some point in time?
Well, we all seem to lose some bone mass. We tend to reach our peak bone mass somewhere in our early to late 20s, and women start losing about 0.5% per year. They go into accelerated loss of about 2-4% per year, and then as we get older, we lose about 1% per year. Men, as they age and get into that same age range as menopausal women and beyond, lose about 1% per year. And they also are losing significantly less percent prior to that after their peak bone mass. So first of all, one of the key factors is to achieve peak bone mass. So you have to have a good diet when you're younger. And then secondly, from the peak bone mass, we want to identify those people that might be at risk and treat and prevent bone loss as we age. And then I think that it would be a goal to have osteoporosis as a condition be completely preventable.
Mm-hmm. And a good diet, does that mean foods with a lot of calcium in them?
Foods with calcium, but you can't block up your calcium. Mm-hmm. So you can't chew your calcium supplement with your diet pop, because pop is fuzzy because it has a lot of phosphorus in it, and phosphorus can bind calcium. So there are ways that we can sabotage that good diet, and so working with nutritionists sometimes is the best way to go. But yes, getting in calcium, for a lot of us it's a dairy product, but for a lot of us it could be just a supplement. And orange juice is supplemented, and of course many vitamins are supplemented, and the least expensive forms of calcium supplementation are usually the antacids like a Tums or a Rolaide. Mm-hmm. Pure calcium carbonate, excellent bone protection.
Mm-hmm. And some exercise that puts some stress on the bones, perhaps?
You need to exercise and put some stress on the bones, and we haven't figured out all the ins and the outs. Some people can over-exercise. We need to do some weight-bearing, but even swimmers that we generally think of the water as buoyant, swimmers who exercise have better bone health than people who don't exercise. But I tell my walkers now and then, you got to lift that can of soup and sort of pump iron with your can of soup or something to also get a little bit more weight-bearing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Our numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you have a question for Dr. Troopman this morning. Let's go to line number one. We have a caller on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopman.
Good morning. I went in for some x-rays about 3 months ago. I'm 60 years old, and they found out I had osteoporosis. I went to the internet, and I've spoken to my doctor, and I've spoken to a couple of other doctors. And basically what I'm told is they don't really have a lot of statistics available on the treatment for osteoporosis in men, because it seems to occur like 1 in 8 as opposed to 1 in 2 for postmenopausal women. So they put me on the same thing my wife takes and my 3 sisters take, which is, you know, the Octanel plus... No, that's the Caltrate plus D once a week, and what's the other one you take every day? I forget. Anyway, it was the same treatment the Octanel, and it's the Caltrate plus D. Anyway, but they said, and I couldn't find any information at all on what that means and what it's going to do to my bone mass, and is it worse? does it get? They just said you guys weren't studied because there aren't enough of you for us to do a study. So what is your opinion on that?
Well, we definitely... Well, I think you're on a good drug. I think it's a good strategy. Of course, I'm not looking at your actual score, so you know, can't treat over the phone. But let's just take for face value that indeed that you did have osteoporosis. Generally, if we see it on a traditional X-ray, we say as much as 1/3 of your bone mass may already be lost. And you know, for a long time, I'm going to digress here a tiny bit, but for a long time, I used to get on these shows and talk about what is recommended in terms of mammograms, but I'd have to quote from the AMA, and I'd have to quote from American College OBGYN and the American College of Radiologists. Nobody was on the same page, and we spent I don't know how many radio shows trying to figure out how to reconcile those recommendations. And we have a little bit of that going on in general in osteoporosis. Most of the guidelines for men right now talk about, and I don't follow the men. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, so I want to make that clear. And I don't follow the male topics as much. But most of the guidelines for when to do bone screening do vary amongst groups, and that's a little bit problematic. So what your physician may be telling you, the collective radio yous out there, not necessarily my you that I'm speaking to, may vary from group to group. But most of the guidelines for men are talking about screening all the men over 70. Now, that would not necessarily capture, you know, you're in your 60s. But if we start identifying high-risk men, then that's going to be a group that we definitely want to screen. Also, I have been told that the American College of Rheumatology in particular is very cognizant about the fact of anybody that's been on long courses of steroids, amongst other medications, but steroids can definitely induce osteoporosis. So getting those individuals, whether they are premenopausal women or postmenopausal men, or men as they age or postmenopausal women, people on steroids definitely have to be screened. And we definitely have to think about putting individuals on medication for that. Now, I think there have been some small studies of these bisphosphonates in other individuals and other than postmenopausal women, but it's not just postmenopausal women, and I have talked about this, but you make a very good point that I should emphasize. Most of the osteoporosis research studies have actually been in Caucasian postmenopausal women, and actually it's only been in the past few years that the genes have been upgraded. If you have a new bone densitometry machine like I do, it has values in the computer for men and for women of different ethnicities because they've finally gotten enough data. But for the longest time, it'd be even hard just to put somebody on a DEXA machine and say, hey, you know, this bone density is, you know, a little bit low, a lot low. You know, it was hard.
Just related to that, the last thing I want to ask is the fact: is it familial? So that the fact is, all three of my sisters, who are all around between 50 and 60, and my mother, have it. And does that mean that if you come from a family where the women tend to have osteoporosis, that you are in an at-risk category?
Yes.
And the only other thing my doctor told me was, he says, "I've never broken any bones." He said, "But if you had broken bones, a few of them, we'd be looking at you also."
Yes, correct. Both of those things are correct. And I came across a risk calculator. When I counsel patients as to where to go with medication, I like using the World Health Organization tables. And right now, they're not very sophisticated. They plot age against what's called the T-score. So it's a measurement of your bone density relative to a healthy young adult. And from that, they give a 10-year prediction of your fracture risk. And they're going to be improving these T-scores. And last night when I was preparing for some lectures, I happened to stumble on, if I give out the wrong website, I'm sorry, but I think it was the it was some sort of foundation for osteoporosis, but I'm thinking the website was FORE.org. But I can't remember what the E stood for, but I'm thinking that it had an E on there. But at any rate, they had a calculator that you could put in your numbers. You need to know your bone density. And I don't remember. I'm sorry whether it asked you if you were male or female, but I'm thinking that it did, but I can't remember. But at any rate, it was a really good tool because it had factors other than just your age and your T-score factoring in for your 10-year risk calculation. And I was going to start maybe comparing their calculator with the tables that I use, because I know World Health Organization's about to issue some new tables. And I was talking to one of the professors that had sat on some of those committees, but they haven't yet. But with osteoporosis, the other thing is that anything that you can do to prevent falling is important now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't think of 60-year-old men as frail in any way, shape, or form. But as we get older, things that improve our balance and simple things that we can do in our house, like little silly area rugs that everybody always slips on, you know, simple things like that need to be improved, because the less likely we are to fall, the less likely we are to break something.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call. You're listening to Focus 580 on a Monday morning. It's the 11:28. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopman, professor of obstetrics and gynecology here at the U of I College of Medicine, and an obstetrician and gynecologist at the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign. If you have a question for Dr. Troopman, call us this morning at 333-9455 or outside of the area code 217. You can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. And I was just looking over some notes I had here on osteoporosis, and as long as we're on that topic here this morning, that the body will make bone density till about the age 30, and then after that, that's about it. And then we have to sort of maintain, or it starts losing bone density?
Well, for our bones to be healthy, they turn over. So we have these cells called osteoclasts, and they come and they're actually giant cells, and they will dig a little divot. And improving your garden soil. And they will dig a little microscopic divot, and then there'll be a rest phase, and then the osteoblasts will form, and the osteoblasts will fill in the divot. And in order for our bones to be healthy, there has to be this bone turnover, because that keeps the structure healthy. And we need a certain amount of density to be healthy, but we don't need it to be too dense, because then the bone gets brittle. So they're actually these funny house sort of square shaped graphs of the density. So you don't want to be too thin, you don't want to be too thick, you want to be just right. And so what happens is that there's something that goes on, that those cells stop functioning as well. And we don't understand in every individual what the situation might be, but for most of us, there's what's called an uncoupling. So lots of divots are being dug out and not so much getting filled in. And what most of the medicines do, the bisphosphonates, the estrogen, Avista, and the miacalcin, most of those slow down the process of the bone turnover. So you're not getting so much divoting, and what gets filled in therefore results in a better score overall. And that score may be less loss than you would have experienced, may not be gain, or it might actually be gain. But the overall benefit in addition is better structure, so that you have fewer fractures. Now, there is a medicine called Forteo that actually will add back this bone. So even with calcium and vitamin D, we need calcium. That's part of the stuff they're filling back in. But we also need hormonal signals to make that happen. So on a microscopic level, we're always regenerating our bone. But on a macroscopic whole bone, whole body level, we're gradually losing because the process is becoming less effective.
Mm-hmm. The caller had mentioned that he had, I believe, two sisters that had osteoporosis. Does family history
Family history, very, very important. So the two most important things, and he hit on it right away, is have you ever had a fracture? And second thing is, what about your family? For instance, if your mother has ever fractured, that is a very key history point. And there's lots of other little factors. You know, in women, we talk about, have you breastfed? Have you been on long-term Depo Provera? We have whole lists of actual risk factors we go with. And, of course, in women, especially because they come regularly for prenatal care, they come regularly for contraception care, then they come regularly for pap smears, we get at least a few minutes to go over these risk factors. And, of course, with men, they don't go in for those checkups so much. But mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe some of those men's magazines will start talking about those risk factors.
Probably should. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number four. We have a caller on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Hi, Dr. Troopin. I was wondering about... My father is over 70, and he's been on Coumadin for a number of years. Does Coumadin have a propensity to...
Yes, and he should probably be screened. And really, anybody, any doc that owns a bone density machine can screen the man. And most, I would think, insurance companies would cover that. I think I mentioned the one... Foundation for Osteoporosis research site, but the National Osteoporosis Foundation, I believe, also is a great site, and I believe it does have information about men.
So Coumadin is an additional risk factor.
Coumadin, thyroid, some other there are long lists of medications. Of course, activity level is important. Your overall lifetime consumption of calcium, alcohol can actually be a factor. As well, smoking reduces bone mass in women. I suspect somebody may be right. Maybe it hasn't been studied in men. I would have to look that one up. Didn't expect all my male questions today.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. We have a caller on line number one. Is that right, Henry? Yep. It looks like we do. Okay. Let's go to line number one. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Thank you. Another male question.
Okay. Go for it.
My brother is 42, and he just got diagnosed with osteonecrosis. What are the long-term, what's the long-term outlook for that? Can you talk about that?
No, I probably can't. It is a completely different condition than osteoporosis, and actually the second most common bone disease in individuals is Paget's disease of the bone. Is the second most common metabolic disease. And osteonecrosis is just a little bit different. It's where part of the joint is sort of disintegrating. And I think there are some sports injuries that can cause that. Some medications have been linked with that, some infections as well. But beyond that, it gets a little too technical for me.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. If you have a caller or if you have a question for Dr. Troopin, you can give us a call this morning. Let's go to line number two and a caller from Peoria. And it's a woman, I understand.
Okay.
Good morning.
Yes. I have been on Estring.
Yes.
And I... it doesn't seem to be compatible with my body lately. So the doctor said to just leave it out. But it also leaves out the estrogen. In the estrine, there is, estrogen. So I am not getting estrogen. And so he said something about inserting it with a syringe or, whatever the thing is. And I am chicken, so I can't do it. I haven't tried, but then I'm elderly, and I don't, it doesn't appeal to me. So I was wondering about estrogen in another form, like a patch or whatever.
When we prescribe estrogen therapies, we have what we call pills that have the so-called first-pass effect, and then we have those that are more either parenteral or what we call transdermal, so that it avoids the first-pass effect on the liver. And to simplify a little bit, when we swallow a pill, it gets metabolized, and it's going to have the most potent effects on the liver. And why that would be a consideration for estrogen is that in the liver are where we make all our blood clotting factors. It's where we make all our lipids. And so the estrogens are going to have the most dramatic effect altogether if you take them in pill form with respect to, they will have their most dramatic effect with respect to blood clots and strokes and heart attacks, which are quite rare, but still over time you increase your risk. So there's been a whole number of different formulations, and vaginal gets a tiny bit absorbed through the vaginal wall.
Mm-hmm.
There are gels that you can put on. When you put on the gel, it has to dry for about 15 seconds before you put on your clothes or you're putting your estrogen onto your shirt. There are creams. I find them kind of oily, but there are creams. There's a new Eva Mist. I don't know if it actually has gotten approved or it's about to get approved. That's a spray that seems like it's going to be very popular.
Where does it go?
On your arms, usually.
Oh.
I think you can do your thighs too, but I think they tested mostly on the arms. The
Is that daily or what?
Yeah, those are all daily. Patches, most of the patches now are in the once a week formulations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the vaginal rings, there are these two kinds of rings, one that just is a little bit of local, and the other, which actually releases a systemic level of medication. And just to treat vaginal dryness, we usually think in terms of medicine that just needs to be used locally. And there is something called Vagifem that's a tiny little tablet that is pretty much inserted the way women insert a tampon. And as opposed to the creams. And even if you just use the cream on the outside, possibly would be enough medication to give symptomatic therapy. Actually, we are in testing for some of these SERMs like Avista. There are two different compounds that we think will be treating the vaginal wall without any estrogen at all, and maybe even some anti-estrogen and some bone protection. And there's a medication, Ofema, Asperfem, and we were doing some of the trials in that. So that's going to be the next generation. But definitely there are some alternatives, but the Vagifem is usually what my patients like the best on. If you were able to use a ring, Vagifem is a good alternative as well.
Vagifem.
Mm-hmm. V-A-G-I-F-E-M.
Okay. And that is how
it's a tablet. It's a tiny tablet that...
Is that daily?
It almost looks like a Tic Tac in size.
Okay.
Now, most of my patients that treat vaginal dryness with estrogen, once they get a pretty good response after using something for 2 to 3 weeks, and long-term courses of medication is usually only once a week or twice a week. So usually you have to work with your own physician to figure out what the right dose might be.
Okay, and that's Vagifem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks very much for your call. If you have a question for Dr. Troopin this morning, you can call us at 333-9455 or outside of the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. We have about 16 or 17 minutes left in the program this morning. Let's go to line number one and a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Thank you. I'm a diabetic, and I've been taking calcium tablets to supplement for my bones, and I have read recently that calcium tablets will affect my kidneys. What is that problem?
Well, you would have to be taking an awful lot of calcium to bother your kidneys. There are some stones that are made of calcium, but usually they get precipitated for other reasons than your overall dose of calcium. And we think up to multiple grams of calcium per day. You'd have to take over 4 grams of calcium a day. And we usually recommend 1 or 1.5 grams. So that's 1,000 milligrams or 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day. And actually, calcium is better absorbed from food than even supplements. So if you want to try to get all your calcium from food, each dairy portion has 200 to 300 a day. So you can kind of look at what you're eating. Nuts are high in calcium. Broccoli is high in calcium. Things that are weird that most of us don't eat a lot of, like pickled herring, high in calcium. But there are a number of ways you can actually get a lot of your calcium from food and not need so many supplements. But it would be hard to damage your kidney just by taking your daily calcium supplement.
Yes, I take about 1,800 milligrams a day.
Well, that sounds high. Most of the recommendations for calcium are about 1,500 max. And what if you're already supplementing with 1,800, you might want to talk to a nutritionist. See if your physician has a nutritionist that he or she works with, and see if they can't calculate how much calcium's in your food,
yes,
so that you can then back off a little bit of that.
Because I can't take any milk products.
Right. But there are, you know, even a potato has 60 of calcium. So there's probably quite a bit of calcium in your food.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you have a question for Dr. Troopin this morning. Let's go to line number 4. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about, are these pills all hormonal?
No. The bisphosphonates are non-hormonal.
Uh-huh.
But then we were talking about an estrogen treatment that is hormonal, yes.
I see, but something like Boniva is not hormonal.
No, it is not. And Boniva only is a bone medication, and it does not affect any other part of your body. Unlike estrogen, which actually can be good for your bones, but it affects practically every other organ system in your body. So usually as a primary therapy, if our only concern is bone health, we usually go in a different direction than hormone replacement therapy. Now, if you have hot flashes, if you have menopausal symptoms and you want to treat your bones, then estrogen sometimes can be an excellent choice. And for our patients that were on hormones and then went off when we had the newer studies about diminishing returns and some of the risks, we have to remember that bone health is not preserved by going off of estrogen. In fact, then the good that estrogen did will wear away. And about a year to 18 months later, the effects of estrogen on the bone will have worn off, and you need a bone density test to figure out where you are with respect to needing treatment or not needing treatment. Unlike the bisphosphonates, which with their longer half-life, actually, if you've been on them for a while and you coast, if you've been on for more than 5 years, they did a study and actually bone density was very well maintained for a year after the 5.
Well, mine doesn't seem to improve. And I thought this was supposed to help you improve.
Well, and I spend a lot of time talking to patients about that. The point of the treatment is to prevent fractures. And the way that medicine prevents fractures is to improve bone strength. And we think that our density is about 75% of strength, and our bone structure is responsible for about 25% of strength if we had to sort of assign it a relative weight. And so when we look at the research studies of individuals in the study where their scores either went down or stayed the same, they still had fracture protection. And that's what's most important, because you don't get sick unless you fracture. Now, also, it's important to remember that we're comparing you against, if you were in a study, we compare you against placebo. So even though your score may not be as good as you would want to show, it may be better significantly than what it would have been had you been on nothing, because you might have been losing even more.
I see. And then the other thing I wondered about, it said it bothered your stomach. Would that only be on the day you took it?
For some people, it develops over time. We think that our lining of our esophagus takes about 5 or 6 days to regenerate. So if it was irritated and you're taking a medicine once a week, that's where they came up with the initial once-a-week formulation. But there are some people who develop longer-term symptoms. But, yes, generally it's short.
I see, because I do have that trouble, stomach and esophagus.
And for those people switching to the IV infusion, if you don't mind a needle stick, it's a 15-minute infusion. We think it's going to be great because then it's just that less fussy. And we've had really good experience so far as only research facility, but because it's just now approved for general use.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks very much for your call. Dr. Suzanne Troopen is our guest this morning. We have about 10 minutes left to this hour of Focus 580. The numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And let's go to line number two and a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopen.
Good morning. I'm now 52 years old, and when I was in my late 30s, I started with perimenopause and got put on birth control pills. Then last year I went off birth control and changed to low-dose estrogen. Part of the reason I did that was I had hot flashes. I was having hot flashes continually almost. When I was on the birth control and even with the Prempro, the lowest dose of it, about once a week during a cycle, I have hot flashes every morning. And I've been doing this, and I just kind of wondered, is this going to just probably be it for the rest of my life, that I'm just going to end up with these hot flashes about once a week and have them for about a week, and then they go away, and I'm fine for the majority of the time. And it's only in the morning.
Well, we do notice that some women have cyclic patterns. We also think that only about 3% of individuals will still have hot flashes in their 80s, and probably only 5 to 10% of women in their 70s will still have significant vasomotor symptoms, and you work your way backwards. So for the vast majority of individuals that get beyond this are younger. Now there's some discussion about once you've been on hormones, will that just delay your menopausal transition? That's sort of a separate discussion, and we don't really know the actual answer. Knowing the right compound for treating these hot flashes is a little bit tricky. Hormone replacement therapy is much lower dose than birth control pills, which is why some women select to stay on their birth control pills till a little bit more towards their mid-50s rather than their early 50s. Also, oral contraception will suppress ovulation. If you weren't an ovulating person, that's obviously not a concern. But right, it is stronger. And now with the new release, the newest birth control pill, Libral, which is given the same dose every single day without getting that break week, that works out. We also know that it may be that in some women, the progesterone component might be significant. So we're testing a compound. There's a relatively new hormone replacement therapy on the market called Angelique. And it has drosperidone, which is the progesterone that's in Yaz and Yasmin, and seems to be really good to prevent bloating and so forth. And the newest in hormone replacement therapy is that the FDA does like us to do dose finding, looking for that lowest effective dose, because we think that will be the most safe for women as well. And for some women, actually adding testosterone can help combat that. We find that in our experience, the testosterone addition is what is most helpful for improving low sex drive. And we just recently have started a study, again, looking at the Intrinsa testosterone patch that is actually available already in Europe after the preliminary trials were favorable in the United States, but it hasn't yet gotten approval in the United States. So it's a patch that helps improve sex drive, and because it's testosterone, it actually helps improve vasomotor symptoms. So the first thing is to get on an effective therapy, and then after that, as you get older, try to get on lower doses and try to pick a transition point based on your general health at the time and what your other needs are, whether there's a heart disease component. We've talked a lot about bones. We haven't really talked about hearts, but that's often the most important consideration for many people.
Okay. So that if, I mean, the once a week I'm used to it because, like I said, I did it when I was on birth control pills. I've been doing this now for 15 years, and it just is sort of, all right, I dress really cool then, and now I'm going to sweat and for an hour every morning. So because this low dose is taking care of the other menopause symptoms I had, such as not sleeping and other ones I had, I'm kind of leery of
changing. Yeah, and absolutely. And we, years ago, we used to really focus on treating what we call quote unquote mild symptoms. And now if you actually read the package insert, I know a lot of us don't, but if you actually read the package insert, all these therapies are indicated for what we call moderate to severe symptoms. And so that if people are having what's mild discomfort or something manageable, yes, you're right. Usually we'll live with that.
Yeah, because like I said, prior I was off of them for 2 months and had a hot flash every day constantly, and it was like, okay, I can't do this. So the once a week, I mean, for a week a month is actually less, so I'm sort of learning to live with that level. I kind of wondered if, so there is an odd that I could be one of those women who just are going to have hot flashes and get used to it. But thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go to line number one. We have a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Good morning. I take Boniva, and I've been taking it for about 6 months. I have scoliosis, and I had lost about 3.5 inches in about the last 10 years. And when I went to the nurse practitioner in the OB-GYN department, she prescribed it, and she said that would stop the bone deterioration. But then when I went to my my main physician about 4 months later, or five, I'm not sure, I'd lost another quarter inch. And she said, no, it doesn't stop the heights, the loss of height. So I wanted to know where you weigh in on that.
Well, many of us lose a great deal of height by compression of the disc, the spongy area in between our vertebra, and it's, you know, impossible to diagnose over the phone, but many of us will have a loss of height because of that. If you have spine curvature of some sort that's being exaggerated, then that will cause additional loss of height, and perhaps there is something that they can do by bracing, that sort of thing, to prevent that. Actual height loss due to compression of the discs and fracturing is pretty serious. And if you're actually someone who has compressed discs and actual real fractures and need to build bone mass, then Forteo is probably a better drug. Forteo is only used for 2 years. Extraordinarily expensive drug. People not on insurance don't get Forteo. But Medicare covers Forteo, except for the donut hole. Don't ask me to explain that, but somebody will explain it to you if you have to deal with it.
I've gotten a little over a year before
But Forteo is often a medicine to be considered. And for some of these areas where it's a little bit more sophisticated, probably somebody that specializes a little bit more, possibly an endocrinologist, possibly a rheumatologist, a physician like that might be an alternative to discuss your case and see what you should do.
Okay. I think she might may have gone already. And you know what? That's going to do it for us this morning.
Well, thank
Our
you.
Guest this morning has been Dr. Suzanne Troopen, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and an obstetrician and gynecologist at the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
All right. And I'll be back right after this.